Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, Pennsylvania's appellate courts play a critical role in shaping policy, and there are open seats on the state Supreme, Superior, and Commonwealth courts. What Pennsylvanians need to know ahead of next month's primary election. Also, Beethoven in Beijing is a documentary which chronicles the Philadelphia Orchestra's nearly half-century tradition of performance in China. We'll hear from co-producer Jennifer Lin. But to begin, the citizens of Camden received something of a shock recently when they learned that Mayor Frank Moran was stepping down at the end of this month, an announcement which seemingly came out of the blue. Moran alluded to health issues, but WHYY has learned that there's more to the story, that the local Democratic machine likely pressured Moran to bow out and is now favoring a replacement in the person of Councilman Vic Karstarfin. All this comes at a time of new challenges for the city, including another spate of school closures and disagreement over the ongoing movement to increase outside control over city functions. And Karstarfin is not the only person interested in the mayor's job. As Moran wraps up business during his remaining days in office, other candidates have announced their intent to run. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has been following this story, and he is here with the latest. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Mary.
Well, let's get to the reasons behind Frank Moran's resignation. He did indicate he's got some health challenges. Tell us about this.
Actually, in his resignation letter, he said he was thankful to the city. In some interviews, he said, some interviews with local TV stations, he said he felt like he did all that he could for the city. There was a statement out from the city that mentioned health challenges, and Moran also acknowledged that in one of those interviews. He's got diabetes, so he said, you know, managing that could be difficult. But as you mentioned in the intro there, we've heard as well that, the political machine in South Jersey, the Democratic Party, wasn't thrilled with Moran. They wanted him to be more on board with some of their initiatives, and that also we heard that may have prompted the sudden resignation.
So he might be forced out at the end of this month then, possibly.
Right.
Yeah. Efforts to farm out Camden City functions seem to be picking up speed. Police, Joe, are, of course, under county control. The schools are under state control. Describe some of the newer efforts to divest the city of some of its operations.
Well, 2 years ago in 2019, there was a plan to move the city's code enforcement to county control, and the New Jersey state government stepped in to stop that. And then just this year, earlier this year, there was actually a study about moving the city's finance department to county control. And the county commissioner's board took that up. And ultimately, the state stepped in to stop that as well. And the effort has sort of renewed this, anger, discontent among some residents that all of these city functions, which they want under their control, they want to be able to manage their own city, are being sent out to county or to the state, and they want to bring them back home.
And how is the community reacting to the news that Mayor Moran is resigning?
I mean, I think it's mixed. We spoke to some activists who were upset by it. They said it was sudden that Moran didn't announce his resignation to anybody. He didn't hold a press conference or anything like that. And this is in the midst of school closures, an ongoing pandemic, the city's ongoing struggles. Other people who are, pleased with Councilman Karstarfin, the kind of presumptive successor of Frank Moran. He's gotten endorsements from local Democrats who say he'd do a great job. So I think it depends who you talk to, whether, how they perceive the resignation.
Some of the people who are now running for mayor likely would not have announced their candidacies if Frank Moran had decided to seek another term. Tell us about Luis Quinones and what his response was to the resignation.
Sure. So Luis Quinones, he's a Spanish teacher from North Camden, born in Puerto Rico, but he's been a Camden resident for a couple decades. He was a friend of Moran's. He said he really thought it was, not very palatable the way Moran was treated and pushed out. And he says, that sort of prompted him to step in and run for the mayor's office. He's a teacher, as I mentioned, so he also was taking issue with the school closures. And was also mentioned in an interview that he's upset by all these companies moving into Camden, getting tax breaks to do it, but he doesn't feel like they're giving back to the city, hiring enough Camden residents and things like that.
Okay, and Camden Councilwoman Felicia Reyes-Morton also likely would have held back on her candidacy if Frank Moran were running for re-election. Describe her relationship with the current mayor.
Well, Reyes-Morton said that Moran was like a mentor to her, and she said, you know, she was thrilled that he was able to retire after all these years of public service, but she also criticized the way this process went down, that Moran resigned, and then within hours, there were endorsements from other local Democrats for Councilman Carr Starfind. She felt like there wasn't really a competitive process to decide on who the party would endorse to run now that Moran is stepping down. And she decided to run anyway, even if she isn't going to get those endorsements. She was a member of a vice president of a community group, Concerned Citizens of North Camden, and she was also on the school board before this. And she is serving in the 4th Ward, Camden City Council member for the 4th Ward for several years.
What are her priorities for Camden, Joe?
Well, she mentioned the state's new recreational marijuana law, which just became law a couple months ago, and it's going to set in probably this year, and we'll start to see that business ramping up. And she wanted the city to be able to take advantage of that, especially given the over-policing of Black people and people of color when it comes to the state's drug laws. As well as she mentioned working to make the most of the city's public spaces. So one example she gave was keeping community centers open 24 hours a day so that young people would have places to go.
Tell us a little bit more about candidate Vic Karstarfin, and have you been able to get a response from him regarding everything we've been talking about the last few moments?
No, we haven't heard from him. We reached out a couple times. Councilman Karstarfin has been on city council for 2 years now, I believe, about 2 years, maybe 1.5. He was a former basketball star, and then he became the coach of the Camden High boys basketball team, which is doing quite well. And he, you know, what people have told us is that he's very well liked, that he is a sort of out there in the community, very well liked person. And he, you know, was popular as the Camden High's basketball coach. That being said, he hasn't been on council very long. And so that's gotten some pushback from people who say, you know, he hasn't really, he's not ready for the job of mayor yet.
All right. We've got a couple more candidates to discuss. Theo Spencer ran against Frank Moran in the primary race in 2017 and obviously lost. But he says he's taking another crack at it. Tell us a bit about Theo Spencer.
Sure. So Theo Spencer, as you mentioned, he ran in 2017 in the primary against Moran. Moran had the support of the Democratic Party then, and he won. But that hasn't dissuaded him from coming back. He filed again to run this year. He's the vice president of software engineering at a bank. He's been in Camden quite a while. And he says he wants to bring, he called it administrative normalcy to the city. So basically this idea that, you know, it's hard to know from one day to the next maybe who even the mayor is right now, let alone how people could do basic things like pay their property taxes. And he wants to make that easier for people. He wants to make Camden just a functioning city government. Again, he says that's important, and that's what he would do as mayor.
And finally, Elton Custis served on the school board for 2 years, so another candidate with education experience. He's thrown his hat into the ring. He was not happy with the district's decision to close several schools in the fall. That has gotten a lot of pushback. What was his argument here?
Right. So Elton Custis, substance abuse counselor, he has also run before for council and mayor, and he's been on the school board. He, as you mentioned, he's been very vocal, even on the school board, vocal about the superintendent's decision to close those schools, because he says people, you know, they don't want to go far away to school. They want to be able to, you know, go to school in their own community. They don't want to have to travel. And it's going to make life harder for families in Camden, and they might not, you know, want to stick around. So He says you're making it harder for people to just, you know, go to their neighborhood schools in Camden when you close this many. And he would push back against that as mayor.
Joe, what's your take on the hold the local traditional Democratic machine has on Camden City politics? Is there a progressive wing chomping at the bit to step in?
I mean, I don't think it's anything new that the local Democratic Party has a lot of power in Camden when it comes to who, you know, gets the county line. This is a whole other thing that we didn't talk about, but people who get the endorsement of the local parties get preferential kind of placement on the ballot. It makes it a lot harder for kind of off the line candidates to run.
Yeah.
But yes, those progressive candidates who might not have the endorsement of the local parties, they are chomping at the bit now because there's this vacancy. I mean, we didn't quite talk about this, but New Jersey works in off-year elections. This year, Moran would have had to run for re-election, and he's resigning early enough that it's setting up this competitive primary, which may not have been as competitive if he hadn't resigned. So it's sort of there's a groundswell, it seems, of progressive candidates who want to get in on the election this year.
Okay, and in the meanwhile, Frank Moran's term would have ended in January. Who will serve out the term?
Unclear. Council President Curtis Jenkins, I'm told by the clerk, will serve until council appoints a replacement for Moran, and that person would serve until the inauguration of the new mayor in January.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll hear more about this as the story unfolds. In other news you've been covering, Joe, New Jersey is once again a coronavirus hotspot. Tell us more.
That's right. New Jersey is up there again for the number of new cases, the number of hospitalizations. It's among just a handful of states that are accounting for most of the new cases. And the governor has said that this is the variants at work, that these more contagious strains are what's bringing this on, but also that there might be some fatigue. People are starting to get vaccinated. Maybe they're letting their guard down a little bit. And so infections are spreading at a high rate again in the state.
Yeah, some people might question that because New Jersey has been at the forefront in getting people vaccinated. But thanks for the insight there. What is the vaccination goal? Where does the state stand in its effort to get there?
It's nearing its halfway mark. It's fully vaccinated over 2 million people. The goal is 4.7 million people for herd immunity. And so it could get to the 50% mark in the coming days for fully vaccinating people. But the Johnson & Johnson supply problems are definitely going to impact the state's timeline there.
All right, Joe Hernandez, as always, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Mary.
All right, Joe Hernandez is WHYY's New Jersey reporter. Up next on the regional roundup, we'll speak with WHYY's Katie Meyer about the upcoming judicial elections in Pennsylvania, which tend to garner little interest, but they really do matter, so we'll tell you why. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Pennsylvania voters typically pay little attention to judicial elections, and yet the state's appellate courts have a huge hand in shaping policy and even the political landscape. State judges from both parties dismissed a slew of lawsuits filed by the Trump campaign and GOP allies who falsely claimed fraud in the general election last year. And any cases that did make it to the Democrat-majority state Supreme Court were turned down. Also, in 2018, the high court struck down Pennsylvania's congressional district map, leading to a change in the delegation in which a Republican advantage in congressional seats shifted to a 9-9 partisan tie. Some in the GOP are now attempting to rewrite election rules in an apparent move to help get Republican judges seated to the bench. But regardless of political affiliation, the practice of holding partisan elections for the judiciary raises serious questions about the ability of judges to remain impartial when it comes to deciding cases. So we're going to take a bit of time to discuss the process, the pitfalls, and the candidates for this year's open seats on the state Supreme, Superior, and Commonwealth Courts. Mail-in voting is already underway ahead of the May 18th primary. And joining us for analysis is WHYY's political reporter, Katie Meyer. Hello, Katie.
Hello.
So what are the negatives inherent in running for a seat on the bench in a partisan election?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a really interesting question. So states do these elections in lots of different ways. But in Pennsylvania, you know, basically they have to campaign. So judges will have campaign committees. They will travel around the state. I mean, with COVID, it's a little bit different, but they'll travel around the state and meet with voters, try to get votes. And they run under the umbrella of a party. So the party is really important. You know, they give endorsements. They help with fundraising. So I think what you'll hear from some judges even. So I listened to a panel of state Supreme Court hopefuls a month or so ago. And they were all basically saying, like, yeah, it's tough as a judge. You're supposed to look very impartial to voters. You know, trust in the judiciary is important. And to be associated with a party so strongly, to have your party kind of, you know, noted in stories and analysis of your decisions, that is an uncomfortable position for judges. And they also don't necessarily like campaigning. So, across the country, there's sort of like analysis, policy level dispute about what is the best way to pick judges. But typically, partisan elections are seen as a pretty partisan way to do it.
Yeah. What are the parameters of a political campaign for a judicial candidate in Pennsylvania, Katie? Are there restrictions when compared with someone who is, say, running for mayor?
Yeah, there are. So the big ones are that they can't solicit donations directly, which is kind of funny because they do need donations. So you'll see, like, kind of like a normal political campaign, the Democratic candidates will get donations from, like, labor unions, public education, things like that. The Republicans will get endorsements and donations from, you know, free market groups, pro-business groups. So in that way, it works exactly like you would expect in any other kind of election. Mm-hmm. But, for this, they can't solicit them. So they have campaign committees that they're kind of separate from, and the campaign committee does that work. And then they're also not allowed to say exactly how they would rule in a specific case. So they could talk about, like, their jurisprudence, be like, oh, I'm a judge who's, like, you know, reluctant to overturn precedent, that kind of thing. But they can't say, like, if there was this specific voting rights issue, I would rule this way.
Do we know generally who contributes to judicial campaigns?
Generally, we do. I mean, so a lot of the campaign finance stuff is still coming in. And so it's a little bit spotty right now. And often, you know, it's not nearly as much, for instance, as like in a U.S. Senate race or even like a state Senate race or something like that. But yeah, I mean, this is public information. Generally, we can see more or less who is contributing.
Let's discuss the openings in Pennsylvania's appellate courts, state Supreme Court first. Currently, there are, if I've got this right, 5 Democrats and 2 Republicans on the state's highest court. So guessing the GOP, Katie, does not want to lose any ground here.
They don't. And so the GOP, I mean, it's been tough for them for the last several years. They lost their majority, which they had until 2015. They lost it in the 2015 judicial election. There were 3 judges up for re-election or up for election that year, 3 open seats, which was a huge number, like unprecedented in recent memory. And yeah, they lost big. And these terms are 10 years. So the GOP is pretty much out of luck until at least 2025. So this is basically them saying, like, okay, we cannot lose any more ground. We need to, you know, keep the seat.
And there can be the perception of partisanship in some of the high court's decision, you know, right or wrong. I mean, for instance, the GOP was not happy with the state Supreme Court ruling regarding mail-in ballots pertaining to the general election last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And so, you know, what you'll hear from Republicans, especially like Republicans in the legislature, people like that, it's like, oh, it's an activist court. It's a partisan court that is making partisan decisions. And you hear that, you know, regardless, like whichever party is kind of out of power on the court, they will typically be upset with the court's decisions, especially when they're really high profile issues. But we have seen an uptick of that in recent years. And I think you mentioned before, there's been a Republican push to even change how judges are elected.
Yes.
In very, very large part because of this perception.
Why don't we get into that just a bit? You know, the GOP does seem to be attempting an end run around traditional election protocol by proposing a constitutional amendment, which is kind of controversial. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so it is controversial. This has been an idea that's been around for a long time, but basically they want to change how judges are elected. Instead of doing statewide partisan elections like we do now, they want to do regional partisan elections. So we don't exactly know what those districts would look like. The legislature would also draw them themselves. But basically, it would just ensure that judges have to be from a certain part of the state. Right now, on the Supreme Court, the judges are mostly concentrated in the cities, actually mostly Pittsburgh area right now, and then some Philly. But, the Republicans say, oh, that means that they're ruling in the way that, like, city people would want them to rule. Democrats say, and lots of also, like, just nonpartisan, like, good government types will say, that's a crazy way to elect judges. You're making them beholden to a specific constituency. They're becoming more like politicians this way. And just to be clear, like, this really came about in this, like, kind of picked up speed right after the court, the Democratic-controlled court in 2018, ruled to overturn the congressional map in Pennsylvania. They said it was gerrymandered to favor Republicans, had a new one drawn. Now it's much more competitive for Democrats. So Republicans were outraged by that. And that's where we've seen this pick up steam. So this would be a constitutional amendment. It already passed the legislature once. If it passes again, it may go to basically a statewide ballot referendum as early as November. So that's something to be watching for, to be aware of.
Okay. So back to the primary election I think there's one open seat on the state Supreme Court. How many Democrats, how many Republicans are running in the primary?
In the state Supreme Court, we have four. It's one Democrat, and that's Maria McLaughlin. She's a Philadelphia Superior Court Justice. And then on the Republican side, we have Kevin Brobson, a Harrisburg Commonwealth Court judge, Paula Patrick, a Philly Court of Common Pleas judge, and Patricia McCullough, who is a Pittsburgh Republican on the Commonwealth Court. And so McLaughlin is expected, obviously, to skate through and get the Democratic nomination. She's endorsed by the party. And the Republican Party has endorsed Kevin Brobson.
Oh, they've all served as judges in various capacities. Do we know whether their rulings elsewhere have tended to be impartial, Katie?
Yeah, so we have a couple pretty strong examples. Honestly, you can look at any of these judges and say, like, oh, this decision was probably influenced by politics in some way or another. I think, one of the ones that we can look for is Kevin Brobson, for instance. He recently, this was during the big rush of Trump administration lawsuits, and he first took a measured approach to, like, a Republican attempt to invalidate some ballots. He said they shouldn't be immediately thrown out, they should be segregated. But then in a case that followed up, he ruled in favor of Republicans, said, no, these ballots without signatures should be tossed. And let's see, I think there's other examples, but that's kind of the general tenor of what you'll see.
All right. On to Superior Court, which usually attracts very little voter attention, but it is one of the busier appellate courts in the country. Katie Meyer, remind us of the court's setup and what it does.
Yeah, so the Superior Court is judges are seated in, like, three judge panels. Usually they get appeals from criminal, civil court, family court, and basically it's mostly reviews of lower court decisions. But, they can also get some really big cases.
Well, yeah, like they decided the case of Meek Mill, correct?
Yes.
Not too long ago.
Exactly,
yeah.
In 2019, they tossed out, he had a gun and drug conviction, and they tossed it out.
How many openings are there on Pennsylvania Superior Court?
There is one on the Superior Court.
Okay. So let's go to Commonwealth Court. Describe its role in Pennsylvania's judicial system.
Sure thing. So Commonwealth Court is, you could argue that it's, obviously the Supreme Court's very political, but the Commonwealth Court is also a court that gets a lot of big political issues. So it essentially, it decides civil disputes between the actual state and, you know, state agencies, if a law is passed that might be unconstitutional, this is the court that is going to decide that case. And then often it goes up to the Supreme Court.
And for the moment, Katie, it is Republican majority?
It is. It is indeed, by quite a bit. And so this one also, it has two open seats. And interestingly, one of those open seats, this doesn't always happen, but it does sometimes, is an incumbent who it needs to be reelected to keep the seat. That only happens when somebody is appointed, like midterm, which happened in this case. So then they do have to run in one partisan election. I should say, just for like anybody who's not super familiar, the way that these elections work is you run in a partisan election once, and then after 10 years, you're up for a yes or no retention election. So that judge is Drew Crompton. He actually is more political than many judicial candidates. He was Senate President Pro Tem Joe Scarnati, who's a Republican leader of the state Senate. Drew Crompton was his chief of staff and lead counsel for a very long time.
Hmm. And in the retention election, it is a nonpartisan election.
It is nonpartisan, yeah. And judges almost never lose those.
Okay. So back to Commonwealth Court for just a bit. Last year, it sided with the Trump campaign and allies in some notable cases. Tell us about this.
Yeah. So this actually was an interesting ruling that came from Patricia McCullough. She's now running for Supreme Court. This was one of the only cases, I think it was the only case in Pennsylvania that basically went along with Republicans' attempts to stop vote certification. So there was a suit from U.S. Representative Mike Kelly that said that Pennsylvania's entire voting law violated the state constitution, even though that law had been passed by the Republican majority like 2 years previously.
Yeah.
So most of the other Commonwealth Court judges kind of similar cases, they didn't really hear them. It was rare for them to be heard. McCullough did a kind of rule in favor of Kelly and that lawsuit. But then again, that lawsuit was overturned in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I was going to say, and the Supreme Court is majority Democrat. Commonwealth Court is majority Republican. So it's just a perception, but the perception is there that there might be some partisan leaning.
Yeah, and I also should say, because people get like it's very terminology-y thing here. I shouldn't say the ruling was overturned, but they ruled against Kelly in that Supreme Court lawsuit. But yes, partisanship plays, I mean, right or wrong, the perception often is that partisanship plays a pretty big role here.
Katie, I'm not sure you've got the answer to this at the moment, but is there any movement toward changing the way judges are seated on the bench in Pennsylvania?
There is, and there always is. Again, I mentioned, like, everybody around the country, I think there is this kind of searching for the correct way to elect judges that'll be sort of minimally partisan. And so, as I mentioned, you know, the Republicans in Pennsylvania, they want to do regional partisan elections. They say, okay, well, at least that'll kind of, you know, distribute judges out by area. But again, you could very easily argue that's kind of a political backlash.
Sure.
There's also been this long-standing push from what's called merit selection. So basically, a kind of panel of judicial candidates is put together, usually by like the legislature, and then using very specific criteria, and then the governor will appoint a judge. And many states do select their judges kind of in this way.
All right, I just got to stop you for 1 second there. I need to do an ID. You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. Okay, Katie, continue. Sorry about that.
No worries. Merit selection, it's an idea that's been around for a long time. And at various points, it has had really strong bipartisan support. Just a couple years ago, I talked to Brian Cutler, who is now the GOP House Speaker, and he was kind of like very, you know, in favor of merit selection. He liked it as a strategy, and he would support it at that time. But, you know, his party just went a different way. And right now, it looks like that dream is kind of, at least for now, pretty much dead in the Pennsylvania legislature. I think the tide really shifted in favor of, again, this regional partisan election idea.
Yeah. The fact remains that election turnout in recent years for judicial elections has hovered in the 20% range. Asking for an observation here, is there simply not enough of an awareness of the impact the judicial system can have on everyday life?
I mean, I think, you know, that's certainly the case. It comes down to judges tend to be less public figures than, you know, politicians do. Often these races just, you know, do not get the kind of coverage that, political, more explicitly political elections would. And it's, you know, these are off-year elections. So generally, when it's not a big presidential election, not a big statewide election, you know, what we have in this upcoming primary and then general are, you know, local elections and judicial elections. But again, like, I can't stress enough, these are the elections that really affect your life arguably the most. And so, yeah, I think it's great when people are involved. I will say, generally, yes, turnout's much lower. I talked to Deborah Gross, who's on Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, which supports merit selection and a lot of, you know, quote-unquote good government reforms. And she was saying she has felt a lot of interest this year. She's felt like, you know, a lot of political groups are trying to keep up the momentum that they had for the 2020 election, and that seems to maybe be translating to a little bit more engagement. So we'll see. But yes, generally turnout's pretty low for these.
I was going to say it'll be interesting to see if things are different this year simply because of the role the courts had in the slew of lawsuits that were filed, for instance, you know, following the 2020 general election. So we'll see.
Yeah, absolutely. They were top of line.
Yeah. All right. Well, the primary election again is May 18th, but Katie, mail-in voting is already underway. So really, at this moment in time, nothing has changed in terms of the procedure, you know, in comparison to the 2020 general election. Mail-in voting is pretty much the rules, the procedure is the same.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's not for lack of trying on the part of some Republicans. There was a pretty big backlash after the election. You know, some Republicans saying we shouldn't do mail-in voting or we shouldn't do ballot drop boxes, these things that played a pretty big role in the 2020 election. But so far, you know, nothing really has changed. You can request your mail ballot online. It'll come to you. You can fill it out, send it back. You can also still vote in person. You know, just, you know, check, make sure you're registered. Check where your polling place is if you want to go that way. And happy voting.
And one reminder too, Pennsylvania's primary is a closed primary, meaning?
No, meaning that if you are a registered Republican, you have to vote in the Republican primary, registered Democrat, Democratic primary. If you're not registered with a party, you're out of luck. You really can't vote in the primary. So, if just check your registration, too, if you want to vote in a specific election.
All right. Katie Meyer, thank you so much for the primer.
Thank you so much.
We'll talk to you soon. Katie Meyer is a political reporter for WHYY. Stay with us here on the Regional Roundup because we are going to be hearing from filmmaker Jennifer Lin about her new documentary, Beethoven in Beijing. It's a fascinating look at the relationship between the Philadelphia Orchestra and the people of China over the course of about 50 years. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. The Philadelphia Orchestra has an unusual and extraordinary history with the People's Republic of China. Since 1973, the orchestra has crossed the globe a dozen times to perform in China, but perhaps no single tour has been as startling and groundbreaking as that first 48 years ago, coming just a year and a half after President Richard Nixon's historic visit. A new documentary airing Friday night on PBS stations tells the story of that first tour under the direction of conductor Eugene Ormandy and those tours that followed. Beethoven in Beijing showcases the music and cultural divisions, along with inside stories and the voices of Ormandy, today's music director Yannick Nézet-Séguin, pianist Lang Lang, violinist Booker Rowe, and much more. It's a fascinating narrative, and here now to tell us more is Jennifer Lin, co-director and co-producer of the documentary. She was also the Philadelphia Inquirer's China correspondent for 31 years, and we do have to mention that Jennifer is no relation to Jennifer Lin, our morning host here at WHYY. So welcome, Jennifer. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Mary, and thanks for clearing that up. Jennifer Lin and I have been sharing this confusion for many years now.
Yeah, well, we love you both for different reasons. So anyway, what was the genesis of this project? What prompted your decision to capture this unusual relationship between the orchestra and China on film?
Yeah, Mary, you know, I'm from Philadelphia, and I think many Philadelphians don't realize just how popular – their orchestra is in China. And the reason is history. So as you mentioned in the intro, Nixon renewed relations with China in 1972. And then as a way of kind of reaching out, connecting with the Chinese people, Nixon and Premier Zhou Enlai invited the Philadelphia Orchestra to go to China. And they were the first American orchestra to perform there. So that was a story I wanted to tell, the history. But there was also kind of an aha moment where I realized this would make a great film. And that was in 2008. I was working for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they asked me to go to Beijing to cover a special anniversary concert. So the classical music critics couldn't make the trip, so they sent me because I knew my way around China. I had worked there in the 1990s for several years. And this concert that they were holding in 2008 was commemorating the 35th anniversary of that 1973 tour. And two things really struck me. One was just in talking to people who were going to the concert, as well as just to, you know, run-of-the-mill Chinese people, there was such a degree of nostalgia for this orchestra. And the second thing that struck me during that trip was how far the music landscape in China had changed. Mm. Now, as I mentioned, I had lived there in the 1990s, and by 2008, it's as if like everything was on a high speed. China was opening new concert halls. They just unveiled this spectacular center in Beijing, the National Center for Performing Arts. Cities were starting new orchestras. Yeah. And I really thought this would make a great film. This is a story that really should be not only read, but seen and heard. So, you know, flash forward to 2015, I think it was, I approached the orchestra about doing a documentary. They agreed. And then I teamed up with Sam Katz of History Making Productions, and he introduced me to Sharon Mullally, who's the co-director. So we then embarked on making a documentary about this and packed our bags in 2016 and went on tour with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Oh, it must have been just so much fun. There are some real standout moments here in this documentary, Jennifer, and one of which is the conversation between President Nixon and Eugene Ormandy, and this is way back at the beginning of the relationship, in which Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger inform Ormandy that the orchestra is going to China. Let's take a listen.
I'm just sitting here talking to Dr. Kissinger. He's just back from China.
I know.
And I thought you'd be interested to know that they're going to invite the Philadelphia Symphony to come to China.
That's wonderful. You honor me, honor the orchestra.
I'll let Dr. Kissinger tell you about the conversation.
How did you manage to get this recording?
Oh, I'm so glad you played that. That's like one of my favorite nuggets from the entire movie. So, Mary, it's kind of funny when you introduce me as a filmmaker because I don't quite see myself as that yet. I mean, I'm a reporter. I've been a reporter my entire life. So one of the fun things about making this movie was all the research. And I was going through the Nixon Library archives, and they have a trove of digital clips from Nixon's 1972 visit to China. But then I also noticed on the library's website that they had audio recordings from the Oval Office. Now, of course, we know that Nixon had you know, liked to tape his phone calls. So I did some backtracking, and I went through the clips of the Inquirer, and I thought, okay, if the Inquirer's writing about Ormandy going to China in February of 1973, I wonder if Nixon actually called him. So then I went through the records of the archives, and indeed there was an item of a call to Ormandy. And when I heard that phone call, you know, it's so crisp and clear. It was just one of those moments that every reporter lives for. So
I'm sure
that was one of my favorite nuggets.
So, and at the time, the orchestra made that trip in 1973. Western classical music had been banned in China. Why did the Chinese authorities say yes?
Because in 1972, Zhou Enlai, who was premier at the time, really wanted to normalize relations with the United States. Now, you have to remember, from 1949 on, we didn't have diplomatic relationships with the United States, with China. You know, there were no embassies in Washington or in Beijing. So So the reason the Chinese allowed this tour is really Zhou Enlai endorsed this idea of music diplomacy, a way of like, creating goodwill between the two countries. A lot of us are familiar with the phrase ping pong diplomacy. Mm-hmm. So in 1971, American ping pong players went to China. But really, music diplomacy was just as important and in some ways more effective because it continues today.
What was the reaction of the Chinese people to the orchestra's arrival?
Oh, for musicians in particular, it was just a memorable event. And if I could just relay a personal anecdote, I do have this personal connection to this story because my father's from Shanghai, mm-hmm. and he left in 1949. And one of my cousins in Shanghai is a pianist. And in 1962, she was a teenager. She entered the Shanghai Conservatory, which is like the Curtis Institute of Shanghai. And in 1966, the Cultural Revolution started. And musicians really had it hard. Western classical music was viewed as foreign and bourgeois, and it had to be gotten rid of. So in 1966, Red Guards came to my family's home in Shanghai. And they took away my cousin Julia's piano. They broke her Deutsche Grammophon album. Oh, they tore up her sheet music. Mm. And life was really difficult for her. In fact, one night Julia was playing Mozart at her uncle's apartment when Red Guards heard that. And the next day at the conservatory, she was punished. They tried to break her hands with ping pong paddle. Yeah. So in 1973, my cousin Julia is working as a pianist for the Shanghai Lyric Opera Company. And because she was a musician, she got a ticket to go hear the Philadelphia Orchestra. And she told me many years later, she said, hearing the orchestra playing Beethoven was like being in a desert and someone giving you a drink of water. Mm. She said, I will cherish that memory. So, you know, that's just something that always lived with me. And again, was part of the impulse for doing this film.
Let's talk about some of the other folks you profile in this documentary. Composer Tan Dun was a middle schooler when he first heard the orchestra in 1973. This was under extraordinary circumstances. Tell us briefly about this, Jennifer.
So in 1973, Tan Dun was a teenager. He was working on a commune. And back then in China, you know, people didn't have radios, they didn't have TV, and the way they got their news was over a loudspeaker. And so he was working in the fields, and as he tells the story in the film, he heard snippets of a news broadcast about the Philadelphia Orchestra is in China now, and he heard just snippets of Beethoven's Fifth and Sixth. And as he explains, it was transformative. He had never heard music like that. And what's so fascinating about Tan Dun, not only is he this charismatic character, but he went on to a very successful career. Most people might recognize him because he wrote the score for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And then in 2014, the orchestra took his Nushu Symphony, mm-hmm. which was his masterpiece. They premiered it here in Philadelphia, and then they took it on the road to China. So they actually went to his hometown in Changsha, which is Hunan province. And it's kind of off the beaten track a little. I mean, top-tier orchestras don't perform there on a regular basis. But the Philadelphians took Nushu to Tan Dun's hometown. And it was very emotional for him. And that's one of the scenes in our movie.
And we have a clip from that. We've got some of the orchestra playing Nushu, again by composer Tan Dun. Jennifer, tell us what Nushu is.
Nushu is the secret songs of women. And in this one village, this one area of Hunan province, the women have a secret language. So Tan Dun used that as his inspiration for creating this multimedia project. It's music, plus it's also video that he had taken himself. And the main instrument in Nushu is the harp. And Elizabeth Heinen from the Philadelphia Orchestra performed that and continues to perform it. And it's really a beautiful and powerful symphony. And unlike, I guarantee you, unlike anything you have seen or heard.
So briefly, unfortunately, we're up against the top of the hour here. Lang Lang's story is extraordinary. Just briefly tell us about him, Jennifer.
Lang Lang came to the United States to study at Curtis under Gary Graffman, the famous piano teacher at Curtis. And then when he was ready to make his professional debut in China, he went to China with the Philadelphia Orchestra in 2001. So Lang Lang has a very deep connection with Philadelphia and with the Philadelphia Orchestra because of his connections to Curtis and then his connections to the orchestra, performing many times with them, both in Philly and in China.
And here's violinist Booker Rose's take as we hear a bit of Lang Lang's first performance with the orchestra in his home country of China.
He plays like he's drinking water. It's so easy. You hear and you can feel the emotions.
There is so much gorgeous music in this documentary, Jennifer. And also, again, some great moments. Yannick Nezet-Séguin there's a moment in which he's directing Lang Lang on some, I think it's Rachmaninoff, and there's conversation and there's singing, but there's also so much body language. It's fun to watch and kind of humorous. What's your take on this?
Oh, I loved filming Yannick and Lang Lang too. And they spoke. That was one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie, Mary, when they're going over rehearsal notes and you're kind of a fly on the wall watching the creative process. But Yannick is beloved in China. Crowds just adore him and he has a real magnetism, and Lang Lang too. So when the two of them together perform, it's really magical.
Yeah. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. So let's just go away from the documentary for a bit, Jennifer. Obviously, this country has been undergoing a painful racial reckoning in the past year. What are your thoughts regarding the recent increase in anti-Asian bias? And have you or your family experienced this?
It's heartbreaking. I have watched the news with anger and sadness. And in many ways, I think we could all see this coming. China, Chinese people, Asian Americans did not cause this virus, but that's how it's been presented. And it's so sad. And, my father passed away, but frankly, Mary, if he was alive today, I would really be fearful for him just venturing onto the streets.
Oh, that's terrible.
So it's just a very sad time. And nothing has happened to me personally, but to friends, yes.
Yeah. Well, and relations between the Biden administration and China have been strained from the get-go. For one, the administration is calling out what it says are human rights violations, including genocide against groups, including the Uyghur Muslims in the Xinjiang region. Again, you reported on China for decades. Relations were strained nearly 50 years ago. Are the differences between these two world powers too great to maintain a true diplomatic friendship?
No. And I think there's a lot happening that is, disturbing in Xinjiang and Hong Kong. But you have to remember the relationship in 1973, there was no contact. My family, the first time we were able to make a phone call to China was in 1973 after the Nixon visit. And my father had been gone since 1949, and that was the first time I heard my grandfather's voice. Hmm. There were no relationships. Compare that to today. There are so many, the countries are so intertwined, and beyond just business, when you think of culture, when you think of education, before the pandemic, there were 400,000 students from the mainland who were studying in the United States. So you don't unbraid those relationships.
Sure. What is the orchestra's relationship with the Chinese people today? We have about 10 seconds.
Very strong. They're still as popular as ever. And I think, there's still a lot of interest in the Philadelphians. That will never end.
Well, I have to say, I really enjoyed the documentary. It was a pleasure. Jennifer Lin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Mary, for having me on the show.
Jennifer Lin is co-producer and co-director of Beethoven in Beijing, which airs this Friday night at 9 p.m. on WHYY-TV. This reminder, our rebroadcast airs at 11 tonight on WHYY Radio. You can find us on social media as well at WHYY.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producer is John Ahrens, along with Debbie Builder. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along. Be well.